From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Cannes Film Festival declined to buy coronavirus insurance. Maybe that was a bad idea. Then the movie Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always follows a young woman trying to get an abortion. Filmmaker Eliza Hittman thought the story was better suited to drama than documentary.
Because of the shame, I think it's hard to get documentary subjects to come forward about what their experiences are. And to me, the film puts a face to the subjects.
And the Moth Storytelling Showcase goes bilingual. That's today on The Frame. We'll be right back. The coronavirus epidemic has forced the postponement or cancellation of concerts, conventions, and festivals around the globe. In France, the Cannes Film Festival is still scheduled to take place from May 12th to the 23rd. But recently, France has banned events attracting more than 1,000 people amid concerns about the epidemic. A TV conference in the same city on the French Riviera was canceled last week, and nearby Italy has essentially sealed its borders. Minori Ravindran is Variety's international editor. She joins us from London. Minori, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So is there any word yet that the Cannes Film Festival might be postponed or canceled or rescheduled? What's the latest?
We are closely monitoring this. It's still unclear. The Cannes Film Festival is being remarkably bullish about its prospects in the face of this global outbreak. Thierry Frémaux is very, very keen, we know, to go ahead with the festival and has been really downplaying the seriousness. Obviously, it's understandable. Cannes is really riding high, especially on the back of Parasite premiering at the festival last year and going on to win the Oscar. There was so much great momentum behind the festival this year, and for it to be sort of derailed by this global outbreak is really, I mean, understandable, but also it is sad. So they're trying to press on. Right now, I think what's happening is, a lot of organizers are in touch with the local authorities and the local prefects, as they're called, to think of ways in which they can reorganize the structure of the festival to kind of get around some of these gathering bans, basically. Initially, it was put at 5,000, but on Sunday night, the French health minister basically reduced that to 1,000. So that really kind of started ringing alarm bells, I think, for the festival and its future this year.
Well, the two issues are, one, the biggest venue at the Cannes Film Festival seats about 2,300 people. So I guess if they're going to be, you know, in step with the restrictions, they'd have to have about half the seats empty. And there's also the market, the marché, which is attended by many more than 1,000 people. So how would they even get around the film market at Cannes, which is as heavily attended as the festival?
They'll probably count on a fair number of people not attending, so that probably would bring their numbers down. But you know, that's a very, very real concern for them. And then of course there is the issue of talent too. The Cannes Film Festival is so prominent because of the amazing red carpets and the glitz and glamour of all of those premieres. So to think that, you know, most of those stars and actors and directors and all the rest of it that they might be afraid to travel. What exactly is Cannes without the talent piece? Obviously, as you said, the market is extremely important. So perhaps if there's a way for that to somehow be re-engineered and go on, perhaps people would. But I mean, even as of today, we've been talking to, international distributors, a lot of whom are saying, and sales agents who are saying, you know what, we're gonna sit it. You know, people are slowly starting to say we're gonna perhaps sit this out. So I think it's looking a little bit dire for them going forward, especially after our piece today and the revelations about the insurance. I think that's fairly damaging, but given the, you know, they were approached as late as 10 days ago, basically, around this. So it's quite a problem, I think, for Cannes right now.
Well, let me ask you about the insurance. Your reporting says that about 10 days ago, the film festival declined coverage by its insurance company, Circle Group, that might have covered a epidemic, even though it had a chance. What would that insurance have covered? And since they declined it, are they really adrift at this point?
It's really surprising that they did reject this insurance offer, but certainly would have, you know, covered a lot of those expenses in terms of, I suppose, venue rental and all the other sort of affiliated costs. I think 10 days ago in Europe, to be fair, it was still very serious here, but the situation was sort of slowly escalating. We had yet to see the cancellation of even MIPTV, which is another TV conference run by Read Me Dem in Cannes. That was canceled about, 7 days ago. So it's really been in the last week, but nevertheless, still the fact that, they were obviously so bullish about going ahead with the festival and not taking that buyback offer is pretty extraordinary.
Do you have any more insight into why the festival decided not to buy the insurance, even though it required an additional payment on top of their premium?
I personally think that perhaps 10 days ago, as I said, I think in Europe, this was a slightly different picture, and we hadn't yet seen the cancellation of MIPTV. We hadn't yet seen some of the other festival closures that we have, all across Europe, really, like the Prague today, Thessaloniki, like it's been one after the other, really. But we hadn't really seen that 10 days ago. It was still very much like global outbreak that was somewhere else. Perhaps that was short-sighted, but I think it's only become real in that period of time. And I'm sure, if they had been offered that buyback option, this week, for example, I'm sure it would be a slightly different story. But I think it was probably a miscalculation on their part, and the timings of it just really were not in their favor.
The other thing that I think is important to note is that Cannes plays a very important role in kind of international film releases. And Parasite, the winner of the Best Picture Oscar and three other Academy Awards, premiered at Cannes. So Cannes is also really important in terms of what happens through the rest of the film year. The Toronto, Venice, and Telluride festivals kind of set up the fall, but Cannes has a very special place in the global film world.
It's absolutely true. I mean, and, in terms of the big Parasite, I mean, to see that film's journey from Cannes to the Oscars, that's a real sort of badge of honor, I think, for the festival this year. They can point to the fact that Parasite's journey began in Cannes. That's a huge thing. And the fact that they were riding high into the spring of this festival with the momentum of the Oscars was a big thing for them. Cannes is the global springboard for so many films that slowly then, there's almost like a sort of a snowball sort of effect going into the fall and Venice and Telluride and Toronto. One thing we may see, obviously, depending how a lot of this shapes up, is, films that perhaps bypass Cannes will maybe look ahead to, festivals like Venice or indeed Toronto. Marriage Story, for example, actually, because it was a Netflix film, it bypassed Cannes and it played Venice. I mean, perhaps we may see a boon for some of the fall festivals, provided that the outbreak is controlled in the next few months. I mean, who knows? It could very well continue for a certain period of time.
Manori Ravindran is the international editor at Variety. She joined us from London. Manori, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, John.
Coming up on The Frame, the title of a new movie is Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, and those words are critical to the young woman at the center of the story. It's rare that a movie being released by a Hollywood studio coincides with a related Supreme Court case, but that's what's happening with the Focus Features film, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always.
The Supreme Court heard arguments Wednesday.
It's the first abortion case to reach the high court since conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh was appointed by President Trump.
The Louisiana law at issue would require doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of their abortion.
If this court were to uphold that law, all three of Louisiana's abortion clinics would have to close.
The movie is arriving in theaters a week after the court heard arguments in a case called June Medical Services versus Russ. Access to abortion is a key plot point in Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. The movie tells the story of a pregnant teenage girl who has to leave her hometown in rural Pennsylvania to find medical care. The movie is written and directed by Eliza Hittman. I met her at the Sundance Film Festival, where her film premiered.
I first had the seed for the idea for the film in 2012, and I was editing my first feature, which premiered here, called It Felt Like Love, and I was reading the news, and a woman named Savita Halappanavar died in a hospital in Galway after being denied a life-saving abortion, and it really stunned and devastated me. And I started thinking about how far she would have had to travel to save her own life. And I bought a book called Ireland's Hidden Diaspora and was reading about women who would travel from Ireland to London and back in 24 hours to get an abortion. And I thought, oh, there's a movie in there.
And it's important to note that Ireland, until very recently, had incredibly restrictive abortion rules.
Mm-hmm. And it was, overturned last year.
So Ireland is not where this story is set?
It's not. But in 2012, 2013, I wrote two treatments for a film that explored this untold journey. And one took place in Ireland. And then I asked myself, what is the U.S. equivalent of this journey? So it wasn't hard to, begin to research and explore, what it's like to go from a rural area in this country to an urban area.
I want to ask you about writing your lead character, Autumn, mm-hmm. who is 17 in the film, correct?
Correct.
She lives in rural Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. To some people's minds, she wouldn't be highly educated. She doesn't have access to a lot of things that people with means and education might have in a big city. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, she is a little bit disenfranchised when the story begins. Mm-hmm. And that is an important part of the story, isn't it?
Correct.
So what is she facing beyond what she's facing, which is that she's pregnant with a child she doesn't want to have? Mm-hmm. What are the other obstacles she faces in terms of access to information or healthcare anything?
Well, part of the research for the film, and there was an extensive amount of research done. And when I say research, I don't mean compiling information or statistics. I mean, me going out into the world to get as best an understanding for what her circumstance would be. So my partner and I, who edited the film, who's very entrenched in everything I do, Scott Cummings, we drove, two or three hours outside of the city and watched the landscape change and saw how quickly the world changed by going into a small coal mining region of Pennsylvania. And I went to local pregnancy centers and I took pregnancy tests. And I tried to have conversations with the women who worked there and went through their counseling sessions and wanted to create as much of an authentic depiction of what a center in a small town would be like so that I could write those scenes with credibility.
Are you pregnant at the time?
Not pregnant, but they do the counseling session while the test is processing.
So let's talk about these counseling sessions.
Yes.
Because depending on where you go, and it may not be clear from the sign out front, you could be walking into a place that might be, say, more aligned with the ideology of Planned Parenthood, or you could be walking into a place that's more aligned with Operation Rescue.
And there's no way to know if you were young and vulnerable or if you were vulnerable. There's no way to know the difference.
And yet, if you go into the latter, if you go into a clinic that is anti-abortion, something might happen. And it happens in your film, and that is you're given two pieces of information. Mm-hmm. One is bad information mm-hmm. about how far along you are. And the second piece of information is going to be information trying to persuade you not to have an abortion.
Correct.
Is that something that was part of your research?
Yes. And the conversation was skewed towards adoption. You're meeting with somebody who is dressed in medical scrubs, but have no, license to practice. So, I went to a range of them. I went to multiple centers to just have, the best understanding. They're all a little bit different. And the experience was a little bit different in each of them, but they are laymen individuals giving information and performing ultrasounds.
We're talking with Eliza Hittman about her film, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. When people go to the doctors, they're often given binary questions, yes, no questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have you ever had this? Mm-hmm. Do you suffer from that?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a sequence in this film that involves a series of questions where the choices to the answer are never, rarely, sometimes, always.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you encountered in your research, or where did that phrase come from?
Yes, it did. It's actually on the form that they give out at Planned Parenthood. And when I was talking with counselors, you know, I tried to play out scenarios. What would happen if a minor came in? You know, what would your concerns be? You know, what would be the most important things that you would want to discover about them in the, you know, 20 minutes before they have their abortion? And they, you know, they really stressed that they wanted to do this interpersonal violence counseling to understand, you know, the circumstances surrounding the pregnancy and to make sure that people understand, you know, that they're entitled to a healthy relationship. And they found that in being binary and asking yes or no, it didn't create a platform to open up a dialogue. And so they used what's called the Likert scale. And when I did this interview, I recorded it. And she said, you know, never, rarely, sometimes, always. And she went through the questions on the sheet with me. And there was something, you know, very lyrical and poetic about listening to this counselor repeat these questions to me. And, you know, the possible answers. But that's really the beginning. And it's meant to open up a conversation.
Autumn, when she goes on the road trying to find a place she can get an abortion, doesn't go by herself. She goes with a friend, a cousin, right, named Skylar.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie is really also about female friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And female friendship when there is a lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very understated friendship about what is shared,
mm-hmm.
who is thankful, how friendship is appreciated. And in thinking about that and how you research teen friendship,
mm-hmm.
in those extraordinary circumstances, how did you approach telling that part of the story?
You know, for me, I have memories of a lot of quiet, or a few in my past, quiet subway rides with friends when I was a youth going to, you know, Planned Parenthood in Manhattan, and just always remembered you kind of don't talk about the elephant.
This is when you were going to get birth control or going with friends who were having abortions?
Both. You know, someone's panicked they have an STD, you know, when I was a teenager.
So you've been thinking about this movie well before you started thinking about Ireland.
No, I just thought, thought about, you know, the elephant in the room and keeping somebody company along the way. And, you know, that was really my approach to exploring them. And I didn't want Skylar's character to be this like precocious, you know, hero. They're just two young people navigating a world with all these invisible obstacles. And it was about them being together more than her having every right answer.
What can a narrative film say about a subject like this that a documentary can't?
Well, I think, you know, in documentaries, it's very rare to find women who want to talk about that experience. And, you know, I was also really inspired by this documentary that was here in 2013 called After Tiller. That's about, you know, the sort of last late term abortion doctors who are practicing in this country.
We should say George Tiller was a American obstetrician who was murdered in 2009.
Correct. And one thing that struck me was how faceless, it's a phenomenal documentary, but also none of the women in the situation wanted to have their faces on screen. So for me, I think because of the shame, I think it's hard to get documentary subjects to come forward about what their experiences are. And to me, the film puts a face to the subjects, you know, that this issue really affects.
Eliza Hittman is the writer and director of Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. It comes out on March 13th. Eliza, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, we go inside LA's first Spanish language moth story slam. Tonight at a bar in Silver Lake, people of all stripes will step up to the mic, tell personal stories, and compete for the honor of winning. It's a regular event held by the popular storytelling showcase, The Moth. And as is usually the custom, the stories tonight will be told in English. But recently, in another part of LA, The Moth did something special. Its first Spanish-language story slam in the city. The Frame contributor Marcos Najera has this report.
Once upon a time, a group of friends used to sit outside at night on a back porch in Georgia. They'd swap stories until the wee hours, while moths flitted around the bright porch light. And so, those star-filled nights gave us the storytelling phenomenon called the moth. Now, you might already know it from the popular Moth Radio Hour that you can tune into right here on KPCC. Or, if you're brave enough, you might even show up at one of their live events somewhere in the world and tell your own story.
Here's Natalie, live at the Moth.
I'm a preschool teacher, and I get a lot of experience taking things out of people's hands.
At these story slams, there's a theme. You toss your name into a hopper and 10 people are drawn, and those 10 get 5 minutes each to tell their story, on stage, without notes.
It's like, I gotta do this moth if it's Spanish. I've never told a story in Spanish. So that's what made me come out tonight and perform my story.
Eric Cabrera has been to Moth Story Slams before, but was never quite ready to drop his name in the hat. That is until tonight, where the Moth is holding its first Spanish slam here in L.A.
La oración se dice, lo siento, perdón, gracias y te amo.
We're in South Central at a community organization named A Place Called Home. For Cabrera, it's a special place.
They saved me from the streets and all, you know, being out there and doing the things that all my homeboys did, you know, God rest their soul or whatever. But I ended up going into finance. I work now in tech. So I did well for myself, but now I'm seeking to be this writer, so.
Over time, he's learned to turn his troubled past into rich tales.
Cuando llegué a preguntarle sobre mi futuro, pero en realidad iba para preguntarle sobre la ausencia del amor en mi vida.
Cabrera told the audience about his life with a violent father who taught him to accept abuse from other men in his life, like a boyfriend after Cabrera came out as gay.
And I had to translate it through Google because there were certain words in English that I just couldn't remember in Spanish. That's why I didn't want to go first. I kind of wanted to gauge if there was fellow pochos or pochas in the room, because if there were, I was like, okay, I'm cool. I'm gonna be able to do this too. So if I mess up a little bit, I won't feel as bad.
Okay, a quick translation. To be pocho or pocha basically means you are a Latino person who speaks English as their first language. Spanish is your second language, so you might make mistakes along the way, and that can leave you open for lighthearted ridicule from friends and family.
I think it's natural the way we speak. I think it's we're so used to saying, oh, you know, my parents were always like, only solo vas a hablar español o solo vas a hablar en inglés.
That's Yesenia Chavez, another storyteller from the slam.
But I think we're embracing that, especially the younger generation is embracing just being fluid between languages and not having to limit ourselves in our communication, because I don't have the perfect word or I don't know the word in one language or the other.
Yo soy de aquí, de sureste de Los Ángeles, Maywood, Huntington Park, Bell. Los conoces.
Chavez told a story about growing up in South LA, where a well-meaning teacher took her and her elementary school friends to compete in a tournament they weren't ready for, in a place that wasn't ready for them.
We were all in it together as poor brown girls in this really privileged white space that was a cheerleading competition.
We rented them.
I wasn't going to sign up because I was feeling not ready. I didn't prepare anything. But when he said there was only 9 people, I said, you know, I have nothing to lose. I love telling stories. I'm a poet. I'm a writer. I'm a teacher, elementary school teacher. So I think I'm a natural storyteller because of that. But, you know, there's 9 people. Let me just make it 10. Last minute. I felt really connected, and like I felt like there was a lot of community.
For Jennifer Hickson, one of the Moth senior directors, these are the stories that have gone missing.
When we were just talking about how can we reach more communities, how can we hear from people that we don't hear from.
Hickson and her team back in New York decided they needed to carve out space for more voices in more languages beyond English.
We can't get the people to come to us. We need to go to them. We need to go into their communities. Boy, Los Angeles, especially. Yeah!
Back at a place called home, Cabrera won first place at the Moth's inaugural L.A. Spanish Slam. He'll now move on to compete against other winners from other slams, but for now, he says this night was already perfect.
I feel really, really great at the end of the story when I hear people, like during the break, like, thank you for your story, because that's what I live for. I live for making connections and starting conversations, so. And it's my first time. So it was really cool.
For The Frame, yo soy Marcos Najera.
And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center. And remember, you can catch every episode of The Frame by subscribing to our podcast. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.